Okay, so I wanted to start today, picking up at the end of yesterday, and talk about what share would have been like yesterday if we had been giving a straightforward brisk share, and what questions we didn't ask at all at the end of yesterday, and use that as a lead into the Shulchan Aruch. So here's what I think a Rav Rosenzweig style share would have looked like yesterday. The key questions to ask are: how does the prohibition of making Klei HaMikdash outside of Beit HaMikdash change its character, depending on whether you classify it under Evin Maskit, or Yirat Mikdash, or Lo Tasuniti? Right, and then we would set up various hypotheses, right, about the ways in which that could be done, particularly which the tabula rasa is Evin Maskit, because we have not anything about Evin Maskit, so we can create all sorts of Isurim, right? What is the pro, right? Why would we see Klei HaMikdash as simply a subcategory of Evin Maskit? Right? Why would the Torah pick Evin Maskit as the defining characteristic? So we're trying to figure out what it is about an Evin Maskit that makes it uniquely suited to be the fountainhead case that ends up Asuring all Klei HaMikdash. Then we'd say, aha, but if Evin Maskit is the fountainhead there, what if it's not that at all? What if it's just a reflex of Yirat Mikdash, right? In which case, there's nothing, right, which implies that Evin Maskit has nothing to do with Yirat Mikdash. It's something else entirely. So we try and ask that question, right? So what is Evin Maskit about if it's not about Yirat Mikdash? If Evin Maskit includes within it the prohibition of making copies, and is un right, and it's not a function of Yirat Mikdash, so what is it? And we could come up with all sorts of interesting hypotheses about what would ban having things like the Beit HaMikdash other than Yirat Mikdash. Okay, then we would ask on the other side of it, we would ask, now Lo Tasuni Ti, the Lo Tasuni Ti, which includes the prohibition of making Kelim on the Beit HaMikdash as well as the prohibition of making the Malachim, right, is a different Lo Tasuni Ti, as one that excludes it entirely. It has nothing to do with earthly, right? It has nothing to do with the Beit HaMikdash. So we'd ask, how does the definition of Lo Tasuniti change? We'd ask briefly the question of how things like the prohibition of keeping things changes depending on whether you view it as an extension of Lo Taseh L'Chapeso, or whether you see it as Lo Tasuni Elohei Kesef Elohei Zahav. Right? Those are all right. You can frame it as the Brisker Shear picks up where Rav Yerucham Fishel Pirl left off. Right? And you can view what we did yesterday as simply a means of acquiring a vast set of options, which we then need to conceptualize. Right? Now, some of you picked up, so sometimes questions like that will be asked, but the purpose of setting up the construction is not to enable you to ask those questions. Right, Rav Yerucham Fishel Pirl set up because he just wanted to make everything fit. Right, to make things fit, sometimes he had to ask questions like that, but he only asked the questions insofar as it was necessary to make them fit. So he's not interested, let's say, if you have three different hypotheses as to what exactly Evin Maskit is, such that it accounts for Lo Tasuniti. He's perfectly happy to write a formulation vague enough to cover all three. Right, whereas in a Rosenzweig share, the whole task is to try and see if you can, first of all, come up with a three, and secondly, see if you can figure out which of the three is most compelling. So I think that even if one comes in with the premise that the ultimate goal of the learning is to come up with conceptualizations like that, you should be appreciative of how many more options you have for engaging that kind of conceptualization once you've done what he does. Right, how many more shittos are flying out there, and how many different combinations you can apply the conceptual tools to than otherwise. And it's also valuable to recognize that there were very great Talmidei Chachamim for whom those questions didn't matter at all. And that is a useful introduction to the Shulchan Aruch, because if you read the Shulchan Aruch, you don't get any hint that he really cares about these questions at all, at least in this section. And that is something of an issue in terms of the nature of a code. The nature of a code under most circumstances is that at least the nature of a traditional Jewish code, under most circumstances, is that it sees its responsibility largely as the organization of precedent. So your goal in writing a code is to preserve as much as possible the language and discuss things in terms of the cases that are discussed in your precedents. You have a strong bias towards assimilating all material that you can, as opposed to rejecting material, and certainly as opposed to rejecting material on the basis of an abstract conceptual connection between one thing and another. When it's possible to reconcile, you will generally choose it, and it takes effort, the code, to discuss a case that isn't explicitly mentioned in precedent. Because you can't do your job in terms of the code even if you leave out whole areas which were never discussed in precedent. So, for example, it's possible to write a perfectly good code of Jewish law as to the treatment of Gentile ritual objects without ever noticing that there's such a thing as a crucifix. Even in the 19th century, you can conceivably write such a code. Right? You only have to ignore like two or three things. Right? Because the body of precedent is still dealing fundamentally with a pagan culture, and you can have interesting speculations as to whether they really worship the sun and moon or not. And in this case, I think, this is an initial hypothesis I'm setting up, because I think that you will find a difference between tshuvot and codes, in that codes, the default setting, codes are organized around the precedent, and tshuvot are organized around the case. Right, and so they engage in different kinds of exercises. So Shulchan Aruch on the whole is, particularly in this section, I don't get any sense that there is any dramatic effort to try and come up with an overarching conception of what is going on in here, let alone a conception that is couched in terms of aesthetic theory. That's right. Let us take the Shulchan Aruch and figure out what really is an image and what is meant by representation. I think you could look very, very hard in the Shulchan Aruch for a very, very long time and not find anything about that. I don't know how much meaning you can give to the fact that the Shulchan Aruch quotes Bayit Tavnit Heichal in this section. Maybe it's here because guess what? The Shulchan Aruch doesn't have a Hilchot Mikdash. He's not going to have a Hilchot Mikdash because he decided only to have Halachot Zman Hazeh. So maybe the Bayit Tavnit Heichal is here, right? And that doesn't tell you anything about his talk in terms of whether he paskins like the Rambam or anyone else as to what the source of it is. He may fully agree that Bayit Tavnit Heichal is a din in Yiras Mikdash, and all the others are din Lotat Shalach Pesel, and it wouldn't matter to him in the slightest because he's just organizing the material, and that's what we have here. I mean, so we start, front. All right, the caption is Din Hasplamim Vatzerot Shalovet Kochavim. The last I heard, the Beit Hamikdash was not something for Ovet Kochavim. Okay, so I want to point out that the Shulchan Aruch structurally is not terribly amenable to that kind of conceptual analysis, I don't believe. And here particularly, the Shulchan Aruch strikes me as pretty much an attempt to stick precedent in. Maybe the real challenge is what do you do when you have a Yesh Misha Omer in the Shulchan Aruch, right, which opens up whole avenues, right? We might think that the question of whether you require a Tzur Shlema or you don't require a Tzur Shlema changes the whole character of the Isser, right? Because if it's a Tzur Shlema, it's only a Tzur, right? So then it's a din in the Chepsa. That, right, is this object a complete representation of Reich or not? But if we say that even a partial object does it, so then we say, oh no, it's not a din in the Chepsa, it's a din in the Gavra. When you look at this object, do you think of? Right, and that would be a very important distinction. Right, I would have nafkaminas for all sorts of other areas. Right, what happens if you have a painting which is an optical illusion? Right, but actually, if you look at it, the paint itself does not form the image that you think it does. It just fools your mind into it. So if it's a din in the chepta, so guess what? There's nothing there. Right, but if it's a din in the gavra, so it makes you think that. Right, and there are all sorts of paintings which are designed to fool you. into thinking one way or the other. So on this critical question, the Shofar just says Yesh Mishomer and leaves you blank. So one has to acknowledge, I think, is that the desire for those kind of rigid abstract conceptualizations, whether they are the rigid abstract conceptualizations which are internal to the halachic conversation, which we call, for example, Gavra Chesda, or whether they are rigid conceptualizations which we can impose on halacha, such as the nature of representation, which I think is not something that the halachic tradition deals with explicitly, we have to deal with the question of what happens if we are interested in these in a way in which none of the, right, in a way in which our precedential sources are not. And then when you construct your own argument, is it legitimate for you to say, I will reanalyze the entire past in terms of this and make selections along these axes when those axes are not endemic to the tradition as you have it? That's a fair question. Or you can just disagree and think they were there all along. Right? That is also possible. Okay. Then, I'm going to reiterate what I said the other day, which is that to think of the Shulchan Aruch as a text, at which point halacha stopped and then restarted, I think is not, at least not fully accurate. So the thumbnail sketch of what I think generates the difference between eras. What breaks the Tanaim into the Amorim, and the Amorim from the Rishonim and the Gonim. We don't quite know what happened with the Gonim. We'll talk about why the Gonim never happened that way. And the Rishonim is the Achronim, and the question of whether we're still in Achronim. So I tend to think that the dividing line is the book. And the dividing line, right, it's eras break when people start writing super commentaries as opposed to commentaries. Right? So the Gemara happens when people start organizing everything they say as a commentary on the Mishnah, right? As opposed to feeling themselves as being part of, right, as being part of something which has it, right, which just relates organically to the past. And the Rishonim end when people start writing commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. The Amoraim end when people start writing commentaries on the Gemara. The Gaonim never constitute an era because there is no work which sums up the Gaonic era, such that people's primary access to the Gaonic material is through some summary work. Right? Nobody wrote that. Right? Nobody wrote that. If there is a work like that, it might be that it's Rashi. But we don't really. Right? We don't really. If Rashi was that, he succeeded so well. That he totally erased all memory of it. So we have no, right? So we have no real. We don't see the Gaonim as a way back to Rashi. The Netziv Hamek Sheila is an argument that the Rambam is that, right? That really the Rambam is opposed to a part of the Rishonim. The Rambam, right? The Netziv wants to argue that the Mishnah Torah is really the Summa of the Gaonic period. But what I want to get out of this is that the impact of those works. Doesn't have to be halachic. It can just be literary. So the easy example of this is that the Gemara doesn't paskin like the Mishnah. Right? If you have a conflict between a Mishnah and a Braita in Shas, there is no precedence whatsoever given to the Mishnah. The only case I'm aware of where a Mishnah takes precedence over the Braita is that once in a while the Gemara will ask, why did you ask a kushya from the Braita? When you could have asked the kushya from the Mishnah, or why did you bring a raya from the Braita when you could have brought a raya from the Mishnah? But halachically, the Gemara has no compunction about paskening like Braita over Mishnayos. Now that is not the case very much when it comes to Gemara. When it comes to Gemara, most Rishonim have a strong bias towards paskening like things found in the Gemara against things not found in the Gemara, and on the whole. And on the whole, at least most Rishonim seem to have a strong bias against simply overturning the Pesach of the Gemara. Right? Whether that bias is absolute or not, right? You can have whole fights in the Rambam, and depends on whether you think that overturning certain aspects of the Stam are different or not. But on the whole, there is such a bias. The question is, to what extent is the Shulchan Aruch a literary device which organizes all the Shitot, And to what extent is the Shulchan Aruch a decisive halachic work, which people do not wish to overturn? So the so I want to set out two theses about that, not theses that come from deep knowledge, and so you are more than welcome to reject them, but hopefully they're at least stimulating. The first is that the extent to which the Shulchan Aruch functions as a halachic work increases over time. Meaning, or at least increased, right, certainly it took a while for the Shulchan Aruch to be regarded as a decisive work as opposed to as a literary accomplishment. And the second is that, which I said the other day, is that to the extent to which we view the Shulchan Aruch as halachic work, we really view the Shulchan Aruch together with its Nos Ei Kelim as halachic work. Right, that the Shach and the Taz and the Bir Agra to some extent become part of the Shulchan Aruch. So that it's not right. If there is a machloket between the Shach and the Mechaber, it's not an astonishing thing, certainly not, at least not for Ashkenazi, to paskin like the Shach. And certainly, if there's a consensus of Nosei Kelim deciding the Shulchan Aruch is off, then we made the standard practice is to paskin like the Nosei Kelim and to say that's one of the places the Shulchan Aruch lost. Right? Really, we have a new Shulchan Aruch, right, where the position of the Nosei Kelim has replaced the position of the Shulchan Aruch. Now, over time, I think the Shulchan Aruch becomes more venerable in certain ways, and Sfardim have a different attitude towards the Mechaber, I think, than Ashkenazim do towards the Ramah. And this, of course, is going to wax and wane in different cultures also. The quote that my Chavruta Moshe Raymond told me from Kellerman in West Hempstead was that to understand the Pesach of the Rav, you have to realize the Shulchan Aruch never happened. Right, by which he meant that the Shulchan Aruch was not a relevant halachic datum in terms of this is the way the Shulchan Aruch paskened is no different than this is the way of Yosef Kara paskened somewhere else. It's a book. He wrote his psak down. It's not right, it's not definitive. It doesn't require you to respond to it automatically and define your position as either an acceptance or rejection of it. Whereas I think Rav Avadia Yosef has gone a long way towards getting a much broader acceptance of that notion, at least among Sfardim, that the Shulchan Aruch is a default setting, such that deviance from it needs to be deviation from it needs to be justified. Now, this problem is somewhat complicated for me, I think, by the recognition that if the Shulchan Aruch once functioned as the summa of the Rishonic period, such that it was reasonable to say that for many, many Achronim, the primary access they had to Rishonim off the daf was the Beit Yosef. Right? If he wanted material, right, so you had the Beit Yosef. The Beit Yosef was the Encyclopedia Talmudic of its day. Right? It organized everything. It organized more than anyone had access to in their own library in an easy and convenient way, and so often people have access to it only through that. But we have to acknowledge that we live in an era in which the discovery of medieval manuscripts meaning manuscripts of Rishonim proceeds to an astonishing extent, and therefore we have access to much, much more information than the Shulchan Aruch did, even not just information that has been developed since then. We have access to much more information than he had about the Rishonim. We have access to Provence, right? So we have the Ra'ah and the Ravid. We have the Ritva. We have endless collections of Tshuvot. You can make a formal halachic argument of the form which says, right, which we call a Ta'ut of our Mishnah, in which you can make the claim that even if you are ordinarily would see the Shulchan Aruch as a binding work in Haskamas Kol Yisrael or some kind of material like that, that any information you have which plausibly would get the Beit Yosef to change, would have changed the Beit Yosef's mind had he known it, right, renders his psak halachically meaningless. You don't necessarily want to do that, because it's not just true in Hilchos Avodah Zarah and Hilchos Tzeros, this is true all over halacha. And all legal systems need stability and precedent, and especially, I point out often, in terms of civil law, where we have this principle called Kimli, which says that you can resist any attempt to collect money from you on the claim that there exists a plausible halachic position which supports you, and that should prevent essentially any enforcement of monetary laws, because some lawyer can always make an argument finding some shita that supports you. And the Shulchan Aruch was a very useful winnowing system, right? So we said, okay, no, you can't quote any positions that aren't quoted in Shulchan Aruch. Right, that's the rule. If we now open it up again and say, you can't, right, say it only means you can't quote positions that the Beis Yosef knew about and aren't quoted in Shulchan Aruch, right, then the universe is open again, all the Dinei Mamonos vanishes. Now, that may not be such a big deal because the Dinei Mamonos have vanished anyway. Because in practice, it'd be extraordinarily rare for any Bezdin to require a litigant. First of all, you can't require litigants to come to you. There's no mandatory jurisdiction over anybody in America, at least. So at least in America, all dini mamonos take place on the presumption that Bezdin is supposed to engage in din or pshara karav l'din. And often, Bezdin is asked to adjudicate on the basis of secular law, or just framed in some way that it doesn't violate the halachic prohibition of which an ambulance. Right? So you can have technical ways, right? The prenup handles this by saying that you are bound by, that we ask you, right, that the parties ask, commit in advance having the basis adjudicate in accordance with the state law as of a given date before the wedding, so you don't have to worry about saying that we bind the basis into civil law, whatever it is, which would seem to imply that you have more faith in civil law than halacha. We say civil law as of a particular date, so we're just choosing a particular defined set of circumstances and not having more faith in the legislature than the rabbi. If you wanted to build a halachic civil law, then allowing information outside the Shulchan Aruch to enter into it, maybe Israel does try this, would be tremendously destructive. So there, and in general, one of the challenges we have all the way through is the nowadays in trying to build a coherent Orthodox community is that. Now that we have access to so many Rishonim, so there is almost no practice which one cannot find some Rishon to Paskin like, or some interpretation of some Rishon to Paskin like. When Rav Henkin discovered that the Sefer HaBatim recorded having a private minyan in which he gave Aliyot, or which somebody, Sefer HaBatim recorded one of the Gedolim who used to have a minyan in his house and gave his daughter an Aliyah. Right. And all of a sudden we had a Rishon. Right. A Rishon, you know, that would have been lucky if he had been quoted once in the previous two centuries. But it was a fine Rishon. But yeah, I mean, at one point he was well known in one culture. But this is an ongoing challenge. On the other hand, we can view these things as opportunities. You know, maybe it's time to restart from scratch, and it wouldn't be a wise idea to take right. It's right. We can. On certain areas of halacha, as Rav Ariel suggested, it might be best to start from scratch. It might be, radically, but I know I have no chance ever of getting this across politically. So I can say it is entirely, right, as entirely a blue sky idea, and I can put in all the qualifiers. So you are listening on tape. Be aware. Of course, I don't mean this lamasa. But hypothetically, if one recognizes that, you know what, much of halachic civil law is not in any way based on halacha d'oraisa. Nobody really wants to assert that much of halachic contract law, right, is based in any sense on a deep religious intuition, as opposed to a codification of the commercial mores of their time. And guess what? We have a system in which no one goes to Beis Din. And certainly no one not Orthodox goes to Beis Din, because nobody recognized the authority of halakha. But there's no particular reason that we couldn't, that for all the fights about joint Batei Din in terms of conversion, where it really does matter in terms of what people hold religiously, or Gittin, where it really does matter. But the truth is that there's no reason, really, halakha that I can think of, that we couldn't set up a joint Beis Din across the denominations to deal with civil law matters. Because you can pick anyone you want as an arbitrator. There's no requirement to be kasher ladin, right, to be an arbitrator. You can pick whatever principles you want to arbitrate according to, which means that if you say that the principles we're arbitrating this is Orthodox Jewish law, then your Reform rabbi or your secular lawyer on the Beit Din is bound by that legally. So Could be that because we have no really effective halakha of commercial laws anyway, we might as well take this opportunity to start from scratch, and we could actually, as opposed to seeing civil law as this completely abandoned area of halakha that no one, including Orthodox Jews, pays any attention to, we could use an opportunity to actually build a functioning Beit Din system that would actually appeal across denominationally. But as I say, this is all that didn't really happen. But you should also be all be aware that, you know, that in theory, if you were thinking about it, right, that strikes me as a really plausible way of trying to make halacha relevant. Pardon?
All you need is the police
force. Need a police force. I think that actually, you know, that first of all, the ADR movement, right, Ultimate Dispute Resolution, right, is growing tremendously in America. My mother is a mediator. I should point out my mother's book is now available. those who wish to read a long book about mediation practices are more than welcome to come and read it off my mantelpiece or order it from the New York Bar Association. Because the court system is so expensive and takes so long, and in civil cases seems so unlikely to produce anything resembling justice because of the amount of money involved. So any small case, it costs you more for lawyers. So the side with lawyers on retainer wins.
What cases are there anymore that pit small people who can't afford the huge legal battles against other small people?
Yeah, small claims court, right? That's the small claims court. Small claims court is overwhelmed. You have a fight with your landlord. You have a fight, right? You have a fight with your neighbor, right? Two people's cars run into each other, right? All these sorts of things. And then there are real cases between corporations and even Jewish-owned corporations, where the corporations go to arbitration anyway, but right now they go to secular arbitration. There's no particular reason that you couldn't set up through federations and CJP and things like that a Jewish ADR unit, which took halakha as a starting point, but which is interdenominational and actually became a method of making halakha or developing a halakha. It wouldn't be against any halakha because it'd just be picking shitot that existed already. But you would develop a common law right among Jews. And it actually, you know, we could use civil law as the way back into making Judaism relevant, as opposed to the symbol of how Judaism is irrelevant. But politically, I don't see any way that one could actually pull off, or at least I would say at the very least that any Orthodox rabbi who participated would have to be aware that they would never participate in any other, in any Orthodox Jewish court. But should that change at some point and people be interested, yeah, I tend to have radical ideas, no one likes them. I also think that the way to solve that stuff, the problem on Shabbos, where you can't get people to go out to obscure places, is to hire non-Jews.
What problem?
You have a problem that we have. You know, you end up. You want to give hashgacha to caterers, right? But let's in the Boston area, right? So we have a vod that believes in, right, officially all the non-Orthodox synagogues are under us. Right? That's the way it works. And
you
so
mean
they're under the vod of Rabbanim of Massachusetts. We are the kafir. We are officially an arm of the Synagogue Council of Massachusetts, which is an interdenominational body, but which has subcontracted its kosher supervision to the right.
Okay.
Right, so that rabbinic master. Right, so right, it gets us in lots of trouble because we're officially an arm of an interdenominational body. The plus of it is that officially we get to set the supervision standards for all, right, for non-Orthodox synagogues. Right, so in theory, this prevents non-Orthodox synagogues from bringing in caterers who aren't kosher by Orthodox standards. The problem is that non-Orthodox synagogues are located in places where there are no Jews. There are no Jews in the walking distance. In fact, they're sometimes located in places where there are no homes within walking distance. And they hire caterers under Orthodox supervision to come out and cater there on Shabbat, and they have to be able to, otherwise, right? Because you can't say the supervision prevents them from having kosher hot food on Shabbos, right? So how do you provide hashgacha? Yes, you have to get people who are willing to sleep in the shul, but if it's a small affair, right, so that means the hashgacha will add 20-30% to the cost, then the kosher caterer becomes economically unviable. So it's a big issue, to which I suggest repeatedly, and everyone says that's very clever and then laughs at me, that the solution is to hire non-Jews.
Why doesn't the Orthodox Vod just stop supervising them? I mean, like, if those shuls don't want to have, like, Orthodox standards for their supervision,
they do.
It seems to be a waste for us.
No, they do want to have it. But the problem is, how do we supervise?
I see. Okay.
How do we supervise? How do you do it? You either deputize non-Orthodox rabbis as mashgichim, And you appoint them officially mashgichim, which gets you in all sorts of political trouble, because now you have non-Orthodox rabbis mashgichim, right? Right? Maybe they're also the mashgichim in your plants, and we can't eat your food, and we can't eat anything you produce industrially anymore. Or you have all sorts of trouble, and you have to hire people, Orthodox people, whom you can get for affordable prices to spend a Shabbos away from their families. And you know, you're not going to likely get the cream of the crop. You have any people you can just hire to do that, or you could hire non-Jews and tell
Why
them their
would
jobs.
Jews be preferable to the
so they can drive. Rabbis. Oh, because you pay them, and
yeah.
They have a job. So you create one lomari afaskase, right? They have a job. They'll get fired if they don't do their job properly.
I see.
Right, and you have right, and you and they're not and they're not empowered to enforce anything. Their job is just to report exactly what happened, and if they report things that are not right, they're non-standard, then you pull the hashgacha. So I have suggested this for years, and the reaction always is, that's really very interesting in theory, it's very nice, but in practice what would happen is that everyone would start a rumor, look, the Vlad is hiring non-Jewish mashgichim, and it's all, right, everything would go kablooey. So someday when you all run the world, and reason prevails, and you can think of all these, right, then you can implement all these ideas which I didn't really say. Or you can have good reasons that we shouldn't. That would also be fine, also. But right now, I guess I can have my other hobby horse. Right now, we have an issue which we keep thinking that real hashgacha means hiring from Jews full time to be mashgichim, except that no restaurant can afford to hire a full time Jew as a mashgiach, right? Because
I'm only part time Jews.
Well, you want full time hashgacha,
right? But if full time hashgacha is only Jewish, how much part of the time?
Well, I'll say we can try, but let's suppose, right? So right now we have a model. Right now you have a claim that let's say all restaurants require hashgacha tamidi. But no restaurant can afford hashgacha tamidi because hashgacha tamidi is a whole salary, right? What is a restaurant clear? What is a small restaurant clear a year? Can't afford an extra salary. So what do? You have the phenomenon of the working mashgiach. But the working mashgiach, right, knows that if he traced the restaurant, his job is gone. Because that's most of his salary. Even if we promise him a job to replace his vad salary as mashgiach, but half his salary is being paid by the restaurant. So you have a system in which the working mashgiach has every incentive not to trace the place. And this is somewhat considered more reliable than a professional mashgiach who comes in at regular intervals to check. But his salary is guaranteed by the VOD. I find it just utterly baffling that we think this is a superior system. For some technical things, in meat restaurants, you need hashgacha tamidi. For some things, we're just checking if things are running right. It might be that having an employee on the spot is right. But to have the standard model of hashgacha be an employee, and then the natural concomitant of that is that you don't need hashgacha when you have.
Oh, you think this is how it works at most restaurants?
Yeah.
They have the working mashgiach.
Yeah, working mashgiach.
Oh.
That's what goes on now, right? Is that there's a fiction that the mashgiach salary is paid through the part of the mashgiach salary is paid through the supervising agency, but in practice, the mashgiach's job is dependent on the store remaining kosher. And I just don't understand why this is considered superior. I really don't. Oh, well. Okay. So now we get to actual Shulchan Aruch. So I'm not so interested. I hope you guys all did beautiful jobs on the on exactly what the Shulchan Aruch held, and now you have to decide for yourselves to what extent that constrains your imagination. Right, you know, he takes and figure out which way you think Yesh Misha Omer goes in terms of whether he paskins like the Rush or not, and which way you hold about that. Okay, and whether you think that the Ramah is right about what it's Torah Chama Ulevana means, whether you think it's machlokas between the Mechaber and the Ramah. But I want to focus on Seif Dalet and the Nesei Kelim thereof. Right, so Sivala says, Asur l'tzayer tzirot shemador shkina, kigon dalet panim behade hadadi, v'chein tzirot tzrafim v'lfanim malachei hasharet, v'chein tzirot adam levado, kol elu asur lo asot, afilu heim lenoi. Okay, if you're not allowed to make dalet panim badi adadi, or it's rafim afanim malachei asheret, or it's rada dan lavado, kol elu asur lasot afilu heim lenoi. Okay, you're not, that's the text we have. Okay, you cannot, right, these are all forbidden, any decorations, okay, any, let's just say, any turot that are, that you are mitzayer, that include either the four panim together, or trafim al-panim malachei asheret, or an adam by himself, those are asur, no matter what purpose they are made for, apparently. Okay, and then there's a secondary issue, but if somebody else made them, then it is asur lahashotam. Interesting question about what happens if you find them, what the boundary is between getting hana'ah and lahashot. And lahashot, and the isur of lahashot applies only in a beletet as opposed to a shokat, but that only applies, that doesn't apply to a tzarat chama levana, maybe it doesn't apply to the rabim, and none of it applies if it is lihislamed lahavin al-horot. Okay, so Shulchan Aruch is this complicated mechanism. Yes.
So you can make, I just want to get this straight,
right.
You can make an enormous tapestry of Jesus Christ on the cross as long as there's no sun in it.
No, it's right down the vado.
No, that's what I've asked. Well,
No, that's only if other people made it for you.
No,
you can't make
no,
anything. Sorry, tapestries. Yes, tapestries you can do.
But no sun,
no.
But you can't draw Jesus.
Well, it depends on what Latour means.
Jesus, like, you know, Saturn, Jupiter.
That should be fine.
The entire pantheon on the wall.
Yes.
But no sun.
Nor do we know what levado means, right? Maybe you can, right, does levado mean it having only that face, or does it mean that you can put him in a landscape? We don't know.
No,
as opposed to our opinion. Okay, I'm willing to deal with that. What exactly do Lafanim and Malachi Asheret look like?
Well, there's a statue right outside the chapel at Grandes that's called the Spirit of Israel.
Yes.
And it's a
statue
with wings.
It's really bad.
Yeah. I mean, it's very Usher. And it's also naked.
It's inconceivable that it would inspire anyone to any form of thought other than aesthetic. Right, that's what it's supposed to be. Right, book in one hand, sword in the other. And it's the angel of Michael, I think, coming down. It's like a particular medrash, but in my nightmares, maybe angels look like that. Not in my dreams, but it may just be I don't get sculpture. You know, I also am kind of cynical about the sacred ice cream cone that appears in many Jewish institutions, which apparently is supposed to be an Eish Tamid or something like that, but no one's figured out how to make flames look like anything other than a soft ice cream cone. I look at all these fancy things, like, good, they have a sacred ice cream cone too. So, Harvard Hill, however, has a sacred hard surf ice cream cone, because it's got the cone and the bowl on top of it. It doesn't have a soft surf, it has a hard surf.
So I'm just wondering, I don't know if this is a stretch, but I'm just wondering, when it says, Adam Levado,
yeah.
Is Levado actually in distinguishing it from the Dalet Panim, or is it possible that it's saying the picture of one person as opposed to many people, which then would change the meaning of Matiri Michel Rabim, the Lake of Hashda?
I can't change the last one, Michel Rabim, that you can't do, because Rabim, that's a claim from the Gemara. Right, Rabbi Mshani, when it's talking about Rabbi Gamliel and the moon.
So
Rabbi
Mshani
is
about
the
idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Many people viewing.
Yes.
As opposed to many.
Yes.
Things
yeah. You want to try and get Levado to mean even, you know, differently. I wanted to say, you know, only a human being. You want to say lots of human beings. That I can't disprove. No one seems to think it's contextually plausible. You can't make the second one.
Okay.
Second one, you're bound by precedent. Okay. So that's. I think. That here, you know, you find like the poor Ravid saying, like, where does the Rambam get to make these distinctions? I don't understand what the source is. And the extreme response to that is, Mitzarna Kazal Chachamim, who says they have to make any kind of conceptual sense at all. right? They just did whatever they wanted, in a way that made sense for the community. So you have to decide for yourself which of these sensibilities you have. I don't think the Shulchan Aruch is thinking conceptually. I think he's trying to fit all the precedents together and passing like as many shittos as he can. And if the result that emerges is, you know, is a camel. Yeah, as a result, you know, and yeah. Now, part of this is that we're under is which we haven't discussed is that there is a specific pressure for coins. Right, you have to be able to engage in coins, and this, right, and also that there are many Jews who make their living selling ritual items. They don't really have much choice about what they can make their living at. Right, so if you make your living money lending, you make your living trading ritual items. That's you know, it's sort of the equivalent now if somebody banning trade in the if somebody came out with a claim that Jews can't trade in diamonds or
doctors or lawyers.
Yeah,
well, so,
yeah, if you want to really claim that Jews aren't allowed to be doctors for non-Jews, that would be a major blow. So the diamond industry would wipe out a whole economic section. So this is what but now we don't have laws restricting Jews to specific trades. They did. So you have all these pressures, and the Shulchan Aruch ends up, I think, largely with the camel, right, which is a horse designed by a committee. You all know that.
What?
A camel is a horse designed by a committee. Ends up with lumps here and lumps there. Lumps there because committees don't end up. Right, committees don't end up with coherent things.
Camels work.
Yeah.
Camels are
better
than
horses.
Yeah,
don't think too hard about this, okay?
Wait, so what kind of camel? A one-legged camel or
two? One-eyed llama. Two-eyed llama. There's, one-eyed llama, he's a priest. A two-eyed llama, he's a beast. I wish that I could see what a three-eyed llama he would be. It's an Ogden Ashpo.
You know what a three-eyed llama is?
No, Ogden Nash.
No, you know what a three-eyed llama is?
No.
A fire. A really bad fire.
Ah. All right. I'm going from bad to worse. At least I'm quoting classic bad puns. All right. So again, so you can do with the Shulchan Aruch what you will. Let's take on the Bir HaGra. And the thing that matters most to us in the Bir HaGra, its construction on the individual shitot is really interesting, and you are more than welcome to find them utterly convincing or utterly unconvincing, as you choose. But the radical thing that, as many of you, at least many of you have picked up, the most radical thing that he picks up is he decides to wipe out large sections of the Gemara. As you pick up the paragraph beginning with Das HaRambam, it says, "V'das haRambam d'chashada eino ela b'tzurat adam levad." Right? So the position of the Rambam is that the category of chashad only applies to human figures, and so there's no category of chashad with regard to anything else. Now, so you have to figure out, when we talk about chashad, we have to talk about what kind of objects generate chashad, and what things the chashad prohibits with regard to those objects. So with regard to what kind of objects chashad is, you can talk about what the subject of the drawing is. Is it adam, is it animals, is it anything? You can also talk about whether they're boletet or shokat or somewhere in between, and to which one of these chashad applies. You can talk about the context in which they will be used, right? Whether it's rabim or litla made or not, and you can talk about who made it, whether it's yourself or Jews or non-Jews, and if it's non-Jews, whether they made it at your behest or not, right? Whether you ordered them to do it or not. Right? Those are all the right, those are the variables in terms of deciding whether you construct what we're presuming now is an Isser D'Rabbanan of Chashad. Okay? So the second, which we'll get to in a moment, there's a second question as to what are we Choshed you of? Right? That's also an issue. But the first thing I want to talk about is V'dat HaRambam D'Chashada Eino Ela B'Tzurat Adam Levad. So the first thing is that, according to the Gruz, the Rambam thinks the Chashad only applies to human figures.
So okay.
In the Bir HaGra,
yeah,
in the middle of the paragraph beginning of Al-Das Ramban.
Oh, okay, in the middle of that, there's about the Ramban.
Well, okay, so V'das, really, the Chvenech Riyah Ran Ayin Sham is really the end of the previous paragraph, but the lines don't end properly, I didn't indent. Okay, V'das Ramban, the Chashada Einu Ela B'Tzurat Adam Levad, V'Tzarich Lamar, Shal Hayor Goris B'Gemara Minu Micha Shin L'Chashada V'Ad V'Iba Yifei Mel Islamit. The Chain Sarach Lamar V'Das Arif, Shehishmit Kolze, Vachi perusho shani ben gamliel v'chuei hata mishum chshada v'rotu lomar b'tzura dan levad mash ein kein v'shel rabbi gamliel. So to do this, we should probably take out the Gemara.
It works.
And so what, right?
It works. You just have to read. You have to read implicitly in the Gemara, and yet Rabbi Gamliel is also bad for another reason, but we don't know.
So let's take a look at the Gemara first. Right? So you have the what the line before of mishum chshada.
And then it gives the bright about the full table of the
okay, let me say it, right? Okay, so we're right, so in the Gemara, we're reading it. We're at,
in the Gemara, and the Gemara says, right? So we say, Lotasun Vibosech. So you can refer to the river, sure, we're over there. Memgil Mabay. So where does the Gemara get to that? So yeah. Shatakta Mishari. Okay, so we skip from. Where does Micha? We skip from. Okay, so we have the story. We have the story of right the Asiya Gradasa Mishari, which ends up with Mishum Chashada. We quote the brisa of right. So we just ended up the brisa with the brisa of the Tabat Shachodma. So we skip from Micha Shin and Lachshada until Ibayis Emes Lehislamid. So we skip till Shana. What line do you think he says you skip to? Sorry. He says, meaning Micha Shin Lechshada ad the Ibayis Emel Hislamed. So the last line before Micha Shin Lechshada is the Breita of Tabat Shechutma Boleit Asur Lanicha Muchalach Tomba, and that was designed to prove that Shana Gamil Acher Masulo, and that gets rid of the whole problem of Lechshada. So Ibayis Emel Hislamed Shane is also an answer to the problem of Chashad. Okay, so in this, so he says that the Rambam and the Rif both wipe out the problem of Chashad of anything outside of Tzoret Adam. Okay, it's only by the ring that you have a problem of the problem of Chashad. Okay, now I just point out here that. When people try this nowadays, they get very upset. When people deduce the girsa purely from the halachic position, right? Deduce that the Rif left this out because he didn't have it in his girsa is a very iffy thing. So we should just all be aware that the Gra was a really dangerous man. Disagrees with what? The Rosh of the Gra is a dangerous man?
Yeah.
Okay. So just be aware, right? You have to get methodologically. Are you comfortable with a position which is really happy saying that? Based entirely on these, right, he has no interpretations whatsoever, right? These are just the Rambam and the Rif, who are purely halachic figures. Because they leave stuff out, they must not have paskin that way. I have to say this, I find this really odd. But then we move on to the Magid Mishnah, and the Magid Mishnah has the fun of introducing a whole new drasha from a whole new pasuk. Right? The Magid Mishnah says, guess what? At the end of that pasuk, it says Lo Tatsun Iti Elohei Kesev Lo Tatsun Lachem. It says Lo Tatsun Lachem. So that creates a deraisa prohibition against having stuff made by others. It's not about chashad at all, right? So Acherim Asulo doesn't work on the deraisa level. Doesn't work on the deraisa level at all. So that's a really astonishing thing to have, right? To have a rishon introduce a new medrash. Right from a pasuk, I say sometimes there are psukim that just vanish and then show up again. Right, to my knowledge, I don't think we found anybody who thought Lo Tasun Lachem was the source of any right was connected to Lo Tasun Iti, so as to create two different Yisurim. But he points out plausibly, guess what? There are two Yisurim in the pasuk.
Doesn't the Rif have his own drash with Lid Lamed Shani? Right, because it says Lo Tilmad Lasso.
Yeah, everyone has that drash.
Oh, everyone has that.
Everyone has that drash.
Oh, okay.
Right, so that's not on these three. That the Lid Lamed comes from. comes from about lo tilmad la'asod
v'lo talamed
l'havi nol
horot.
That's not original. Yeah,
okay,
that's not original. But this, so we saw that somebody made up the ishtamush eluhu, right? That was a new drasha, and we decided that ishtamush eluhu means, is it forbidden to be mishtamesh, or is it forbidden asui l'ishtamesh, or is it forbidden derech tashmesh, even though none of those were explicitly in the Gemara. And now we have a whole new drasha for the whole new pasuk, or at least a whole new phrase of the pasuk. And magically this only applies to things that are in the Madur Ilyon, but in the Madur Tachton there's no such prohibition. This is an attempt to try and explain how the Rambam can make this distinction. Right, that's basically what he's trying to do, right? He's trying to figure out how can the Rambam make this distinction. Then within Chashad we have the position of the Ran. The Ran Katav, the Ein Chashad Ella Be'otan Regilin Ol De'Kuchav Nodan Bizmanahu. Okay, the Ran is the one who is quoted as taking the position that we can update Chashad as opposed to freezing it. And so it's only Chashad if it's a Chashad now. Right? So the disadvantage of that is that it might end up asurin crosses. The advantage of it is that it probably allows pictures of Greek and Norse gods, at least until those religions are revived. And that's always a choice you have to make, right? Because you have a Mishnah, which says Surat Chama and Surat Levana. I don't think that the Shulchan Aruch really thought that Chashad applied particularly to Surat Chama and Surat Levana. I think he was following precedent. And he decided, right, and he said, even if the world changed, we can't change the halacha. Or we have no need to change the halacha, because if we change the halacha, we're going to end up bastering crucifixes. And then finally, you have the position where you say, "Well, that's Tosas Harash, left for the Mina Torah, ain't Asur, El Asatan, Kolotrod, by a Tavni Vadam, Vadafka Boltot, Madur Tafton Afshokot." The key line here is the Midrabanan, we're in the last paragraph of the first paragraph, Midrabanan Asur, Afla Hashotan, Otan Asur Lasotan, Mishun Chashada Dasiatan. And then Darkan, right? So as we'll go understand, the Tosas has this really wonderfully complicated position that there are two kinds of Chashad. Right. Anything which is usher to make, it's usher to possess out of a chashad that people might think you had made it. And by the way, dragons are a chashad of Avodah Zarah. Right, so the Tosfos ends up with a two-part chashad. Right, but you can construct it however you want. So you can decide for yourself how relevant chashad is as a halachic category at all in the province of art. Right? So a fair question is, do you believe that nowadays that there is any concern whatsoever that paintings or sculptures, if you have them in your house, that people will suspect you of worshipping them? And I'll give you an easy instance of this. Many Jews, including some related to me, have African masks hanging in their house. Now, these African masks are certainly imitations of things that at one point had religious significance. It doesn't seem to me terribly likely that people really suspect these people of worshipping them. But that's all. On the other hand, you can either formulate the chashad as the chashad is anything. Chashad applies to those things which were worshipped in their time. You can apply chashad to those things that are worshipped in our time, and you can apply chashad to those things which is plausible to suspect people here of worshipping, which are different categories. And because I don't think that those kind of African religions are likely to have so much significance for Jews nowadays. But who knows? Maybe I'm wrong, and I haven't quite gotten over people reviving Ashtarte. Yes. Right, so I think that that Catholic images is really a big concern, and partially depends on what your vision of Catholicism is, right? But it's very hard to say that people do not engage in acts of worship towards Catholic images, right? You have to decide whether it's Avodah Zarah or not, and you are, but it's very hard to imagine to say that those are non-religious images. But as the African images mostly are produced of kitsch now.
Yeah.
Right? The tourist thing. The tourist thing.
Right, but they're important. I mean, like, I had a lot of people who have, like, say, like, actual idols of Eastern religions in their houses, even though, you know, they don't believe in Eastern religions, and there's, you know, what do you say? These are things that, you know, are ne'avad in general by a lot of people in a lot of places, and yet still, do I think that there's a reasonable hashad of this person worshipping it? No, but at what point do you, right, how much do you extend, right, hashad to what is plausible hashad? Right, or at what extent do you keep it, like, in the, you know, whatever Ethereum we have a hashad with, like, Rabim and Islam and that sort of thing?
That's right. So part of the, question here is, there are things that we all feel are probably, or many of us probably feel, are wrong. Right? You feel uncomfortable if you walk into someone's house and you see a big statue of Dagon with the head still on. All right, that would feel somehow disloyal. Dagon is the Philistine fish god who gets knocked over when the Aaron, right, when they take over the Aaron, right? So if we'd all see like that, yeah, that just feels wrong. That's right, to have an idol of Dagon in your house with the head intact. Or if people have clay idols of Ashtarte just for show, right? You know, that would that's the one that still gets me, because there was a story later denied in years ago, which I have to keep repeating because people don't believe it actually happened, and then they sort of it happened. Couldn't have made it up. In which a Jewish magazine published an interview with a Reconstructionist rabbinic student, in which she talked about how she had found this. Found the abstract religion of Judaism not quite enough for her, and so she had decided to try and find out what it would be like if you had a more material religion, and she made a clay idol of Ashtarte, bowed down to it. It was a whole scandal whether they would let her graduate or not. So she had to deny it in order to graduate.
No, there's like Mohammed school.
I don't know what this is.
Oh, there's I don't know, there's these people who started a Mohammed school to revive the ancient tradition of Jewish priestesses. Which I think they're basically like Jewish Wiccans, and they're calling themselves Kohenets, and they're like,
yes.
I think it's like they're like
early experience.
That's a great article.
Early experience at a klal interdenominational rabbinic conference where we're learning Yecheskel, and I was told by my chavrutot that obviously the, you know, we learned from this text that the worship of the Queen of Heaven is an ancient Jewish practice. The whole tension of using history as a source. So I think the question is, right, this is a question all years halacha, is everything that, should everything that is wrong be usur? Right, that's really...
Or if it is usur, right, for what reason is it usur, right? I mean, like, if we're going to usur this, should we usur it because of chashah?
Yeah.
Are we being honest if we're doing that?
Right, but I think that's I think those are good questions, and really, I think one has to recognize that in order to get the halacha to exactly conform to what you think ought to be usur, you have to do a lot of fancy work and a lot of reshaping and choosing among precedents. So you have to decide if you're willing to pay the price of creating an obviously artificial halacha in order to make sure that everything you want to be usur is usur and everything you want to be mutur is mutur. Or whether you're willing to say, you know what, there are these things that are usur, these things that are usur, these other things that are mutur. But, now that's what I think a lot of the achronim do here. Right? A lot of the achronim recognize that the halacha has holes through which useful things can, through which really usur things can fall. All right, and so the answer to that is things like hamachner tov alo of bracha, and what is the chol hamachner is in the shubach. What's the other one other thing we have? Yesh lihizayir, right? That's right. All those are things which say, you know what, these are things that probably mechura davar. These are things that should be usur. But technically, there's no way to usur them without usuring lots of other stuff. And we don't really want to usur all the other stuff. Or, you know, right, I don't find it plausible that the technical arguments cover them. So what I'll tell you is it's mutter, but I really don't want you to do it. Right, and you have moments of humor. So I think that if you look at the shach, if cut and chasped, I just think it's a fun line. Right, so he has, usur l'asotam afilu noi, v'chein kasav v'ramam peregimel. But he says, "V'sefer yamachaberim hayishanim, katuv afilu l'ovik kochavim." Right. So this is one. Just realize, here's the errors that happen even in the Shulchan Aruch. And the fun one here is whether it says afilu l'noy or afilu l'goy. Right. So it's forbidden. Right. If it says afilu l'goy, the assumption is not that it's forbidden for a non-Jew to make it, but it's forbidden for you to have it, even if it was made by a non-Jew. Right, so people go, right, to which, I think it's just a great line. The Shach says, right, the Elu Be'elu Zivre Elu Kim Chayim, they came with the Kapi Gras, see ya? Ein Chiluk Ben Elsu Lenoi Olam Ar... Right, I thought, it's just a great line, right? Everything should be up. Okay, right, but, you know, but if you look at the end of the Shach Alam Abed, he says, Amachmir Bechol Zeh Tzavo Olav Bracha. Right, so it's pretty clear, the Shach thinks that there's really no reason, there's really no reason anybody should be looking for Heterim. Right, if you look at the Pispei Tshuva, by the next page, Siman Kuf Mem Aleph Siv Zayin, so the Pispei Tshuva says, right, he says, Ayin B'Sefer Yaros Dvash Kelek Alav Zvush Bet, Shemaz Hir Me'od, Shlo Yiyot B'toch HaBayit Tzura Mitzuyar B'Kotol HaBaluach, Afal Pit B'min Hadin Ein Yisra Rak B'Tzura B'Letet, Mikol Miyash, Makol Miyash Lizahir. Right, so there you have an explicit statement that I can't after this, but it's really wrong, so don't do it. Although Professor Lyman claimed that oil portraits of Rav Yonath Eibishitz himself were actually hanging in most homes in Europe. So apparently there was a prohibition against things on the wall, but not separate paintings. I don't know why the culture of Luach is. Okay, so this is the... So the underlying question really is it would be easy to frame the entire halachic conversation solely around the question of which things are usur and which things are really bad ideas. Right, we could frame it that way. There was a years ago in one of the darker moments of Wayu, when it was felt that there weren't any Rosh Yeshiva who actually supported the official ideal of the institution, so there was, I think Rosh Shefter gave one of the Torah Model lectures, which was called Torah Model Lechatchila or Bidiyavid. And so just like the question sort of shocked people. Like most institutions don't have among their leading lights give lectures about whether the institution is something that you can tolerate, but really should never have happened in the first place. Rosh Shefter actually has come out, has liberalized dramatically, it seems, on that issue. Since there, he pretty much said Bidiyavid, but he has said different things. Otherwise, it depends what you mean. But so for Purim, we put out a big thing and say, Taramata Bidiyavid or Asr Lagamri. Right, lectures by our most liberal Rosh Yeshiva on the subject. And you can do it this way, right? You know, say, art. Right. Mechura Dabar. Or Asr. And we could easily frame the whole conversation that way, if you think that. And the underlying thing is that nowhere in this conversation is there any kind of counter value. Right? Nobody here ever suggests that there's any motive for allowing these things. Right? Nobody says, of course, there's grounds for Machmir, but let's be Makil, because after all, it's beautiful. So the question is, what happens if you feel that way? Right? What happens if you think there is a value to value in certain kinds of pictures, whether they be pictures of the zodiac, or right, which is maybe not so important, or pictures of human beings, which is very likely to be things, right? That there's an issue about that, or pictures of animals, or the sun, moon, and stars. If we happen to be into that. Now there are secondary. Now usually, it breaks down that when you're talking about pictures of human beings, we're talking about art mostly. When you're talking about pictures of sun, moon, and stars, you're mostly talking about astronomy. And on the whole, I think that most of us have come to terms with astronomy, and right, although you have some people writing tshuvot trying to figure out why it is we have pictures in astronomy textbooks and trying to ban them, but most of the halakhic world has pretty much come to terms with astronomy textbooks and recognize that we don't really want our children to grow up ignorant. Right? And on the whole, the Copernican worldview has taken over, you know, even in the most right wing of Orthodoxy, there are not so many people who think that that the earth is fixed at the center of the universe and everything goes around it. I think, interestingly enough, the Copernican revolution has triumphed. Right? The model of the age of the universe is still very much in controversy. And models of the origin of species, all those are still in play. But I think that the Copernican universe mostly has won, and I have to say I think that that's reasonable, because with regard to all the others, you're talking about reconstructions of the past. About the Copernican universe, we now have pictures. So unless you think that NASA is faking it, it's right, you know, we have pictures of the Earth. Right? We pretty much know that. I understand.
You have pictures of the Earth. You don't have pictures of what's revolving around what.
Yeah, but you have pictures. You have pictures of star. You have pictures of star charts. No, so which revolves around what? I understand. So we can revive it. We don't really have a pure Copernican model either. Anyway, you pick your point and everything moves.
Right.
But the notion that everything moves in circles around it, as opposed to everything moves relative to it, that's a very hard thing to say.
Right.
There's empirical evidence now that it's hard to sustain it, as opposed to reconstructions based on empirical evidence. So if I have to pick one of those three that to give in on, I would pick the notion that the Earth is stable and everything moves around it. I think I would give up on that one if I had to pick. Yes, Rachel.
So I'm just wondering, though, it seems like also images of, you know, like astronomy and things, whatever, stars and moons, all of that can have a scientific benefit, but I'm just wondering, you mentioned earlier about like copies of things, or
right,
you know, exact copies or whatever, and I mean, if we're looking at it from like a photography kind of perspective, then I mean, how do pictures play a role in images of human beings?
Right, so this is also, so I tend to think that we live in a culture where the photography fight has also been lost. We'll see. There are chuvot that still oppose photography of human beings. But we live in a culture where everybody in the film world takes videos of their kids. And you can decide which way you think the omnipresent pictures of the Lubavitcher Rebbe drive you. Right? Do they drive you to think it's obviously mutter to have pictures of human beings on the wall? Or do they drive you to say, wow, this really is a good way to spread Avodah Zarah? And I tend, honestly, to be in the latter category. The pictures of the Rebbe are, to me, terribly frightening. Terribly frightening. Even though I know that. Yu'einecha ro'ot et morecha. I know all that. But not so much. Let's see him less. Let's at least see different images. I can do without. I think.
But what if you have a picture of the Rebbe in your house and also, like,
yeah, so again, I'm not saying I can't say it's usher to have a picture of, you know, it's mutter to have a picture of the Rav, but it's usher to have a picture of the Rebbe, and it's mutter to have a picture of the Rebbe, it's usher to have a picture of the Rebbe or the Rav, but it's mutter to have a picture of your 3-year-old son. Right? It's very hard to say. Yeah, and I can't even make the distinction on the basis of ritual, because hanging up pictures of your kids and your parents is a ritual. Everyone has them in their home for ritual purposes. So it's very hard to say that. But on the other hand, I think that it's a reminder. But I want to bring up one. Pardon?
Sorry, this whole conversation.
Yeah.
What is the point of it?
Well, for yourself, right? I want to recognize you can. If you want to write halacha, so there's two things I want to get. One is that you have to be aware of audience. And if you're writing to artists, okay, so even if you find a technical way to be matir, let's suppose an artist sent you a shayla and said, I just painted this picture. Right, I'll call it Brooklyn Crucifixion. Right, of my mother against the bedroom window, right, with her arms spread as a way of showing how my mother had sacrificed herself for the cause of Chabad. Okay, that's the painting at the end of my name is Asher Lev.
Okay.
Okay, I just killed the book for you, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just read that part.
Okay, good. So let's suppose I write a tshuva in which I explain that this painting is technically mutter, but really, if that's an awful thing to do, you shouldn't do that again. And by the way, the whole enterprise of painting, really, we would rather ban, but if it turns out that, right, that your poor sainted mother is now living on welfare, and this is the only skill you have, Rahman al-Islam, so you can support her by painting pictures So I allow you to paint pictures of apples. Right? Or I allow you to paint pictures of whatever you want to make money, because technically it's mutter. Right? That doesn't... That, right, so the fact that you only think it's mutter b'dieved, and you see no value in it other than its commercial things, is in of itself a powerful statement. And of course, if you were writing a code as opposed to a tribute to a particular artist, you would write that it's all utter, because you don't see any reason it shouldn't be. So you pick the machmir positions, right? So-and-so says this, now machmir kidvarav, tavolov rapa, right? So it makes it, right, so you have, so I think it makes a big difference as to whether you see art as worthwhile, in which case you are much more likely to pick the positions that allow things, and you're much, pardon? So I'm showing you the Achronim in reverse, right? They're telling you Hamachner Tel Velov Abracha left and right.
But that's different than taking the more Machner opinion. That's just saying you can be Machner.
So we have, right, so we take...
It's a good idea to be Machner, but it's not saying that... It's not taking the more Machner position and saying that that's what you must do.
So let's take a look at the Pitzchei Tshuva, Sifkat and Chet. All right, so he says, I am the Shudder Rekochavim, I am the Shudder Yosef Simen Chet, Shenishal, אם ציהרו בדלתות היכל של בית הכנסת מבפנים צורת כוכבים בסמנים ואפרות זהב, אם יש צד היתר לקיימם. ואף דזן אלו בלית ולא שוקע כמו שכתב מהרם, so lots of grounds we might hear. מכל מקום, מדברי הרם נראה את ציר בצבע דין אחד כמו בשוקע, ויש להחמיר כדבריו. Right. Now, he knows perfectly well he can pass in the other way. Right. But, and he's not telling you that it's obvious this is true, but he doesn't say any reason not to. Right? That's a perfectly reasonable way to function halachically. If you see no reason, to be master, then why shouldn't it be choshesh? Right? If somebody asked me, can I pass him like the other way? Well, it depends. Are you asking me the shayla, or are you asking somebody else the shayla? If you're asking me the shayla, I'll tell you it's usher. I'm not going to tell you that somebody else wouldn't tell you it's mutter. I'm not going to tell you to be wrong if they told you it's mutter. But me, I think that position makes sense.
I don't know. They just seem kind
of emotionally stuck with me. I don't know why. Okay, good. So we're thinking about it. I'm trying to put it as starkly as I can.
Can't there be restrictive?
We could do that, right? We can create a space and say we could come with an intermediate category and say, you know what? They're just pictures. Halacha doesn't care about them one way or the other. All right.
Does
so
have to address every issue?
No. That's what we can do. But I think it makes a real... I think that once you see that you have an almost infinite array of positions in the Rishonim, all of which are defensible in the Gemara, so it makes sense that that the way you paskin should be framed by what you think is valuable and not valuable.
This doesn't make sense at all.
All right, we'll have the conversation. We'll finish the conversation afterwards.
You take a quick survey of everything written in the Gemara.
Yeah.
There is no value. And that might be much more powerful than anything else, is that despite the fact you can't prove it, every single commentator on Shachara insists on throwing in several comments about why this is a horrible idea, and not a single person has any qualms about that whatsoever.
I think it's fair to say that in the Nosei Kelim, nobody feels that their life would be impoverished if they saw fewer pictures.
I think if you want to be fair to the Nosei Kelim, you have to frame it much more.
Frame it much more starkly.
I think a quick survey of the Nosei Kelim tells you that they think religious life would be much better if people stopped with images entirely,
except possibly for paintings of them. You have to know the reality, right? In terms of what really existed when they're banning images of stars on the doors of the shul. Are they at the same time cheerfully patting the lions as they walk in? I don't know. But what we don't have, in these tshuvot, right, and in these halachic topics, what we don't have is anybody pushing back against these halachot explicitly. Right, they do create vast areas of heter. But their rhetoric, right, like you can have people create a theorem, anything flat. Right, anything painted, it's all mutter. But I think it's fair to say that if I were an artist reading this, I would be depressed. Because nobody recognizes that what I do is important anyway. Now, we'll see, right? Of course, there is rhetoric about beauty that people could use. But we don't have that. So a fair question is, right? So Jonathan, as I understand it, wants to argue that since we don't see any achronim here who think that art has any value at all, so why should we think that art has any value? So let's pardon?
Do they think that reading Shakespeare had any value?
We'll discuss it, but probably. But there.
Do you think that today?
Do we?
Yeah, this isn't part of it.
Yeah. So Jonathan, right now is in a very shall we say nonfiction oriented mood.
Okay. Well, modern Orthodox high school, they're reading Shakespeare. Is very
yes.
Important.
So a big so a big part of the challenge
so
that. That's a good question.
Most
of them will tell you the Rav said I could do this.
So then we have to go to the Rav.
Rav's dead.
No, or
we can write Kristoff.
No!
No, we can write Kristoff to his grave.
No, meaning, wait, they say that in terms of, like, speech or in terms of...
Anything.
Like, in terms of, like, there's recorded document in which he said that.
He taught it in Maimonides.
He quotes it everywhere.
I don't know,
we should look at it. And Erlichenstein does, right? So, and you can talk about Erlichenstein's defenses. But I think that this may be... there are two sources of pushback. One is your support of the culture that, right, if you, this is the culture you, right, that you identify with religiously, so you think that, and there are all sorts of halachic language for it. Puchazi mayam adavar, right?
Okay.
Right? Puchazi mayam adavar says, you know, where the halacha is ambiguous, you go out and you see what some people are doing. And that's the halacha. And I love quoting, Marat Chayes tells you that your obligation as a rabbi in a frum community is to justify every practice of your community, even if that requires relying on an outlandish shitas yachid. You should never criticize a practice of the frum community unless you have ethical grounds for doing so. Right, this is Shlomo Brody's undergraduate thesis. But it's in Mishpat HaHorah. In general, right, there's a dominant halachic mode which says that you're supposed to defer to the practice of the frum community. So you can defend it on the grounds that I believe that this community is a frum community, this community does this. So unless I really see grounds for it to be wrong, my job is to find out how they thought it. Or you can say that, you know what, I don't think the community matters very much, but Rosenstein said it. I can't say it's us to read Paradise Lost. Rosenstein tells me to read Paradise Lost. And that's it. Or C.S. Lewis. All of which are works that, you know, that certainly have were written with Christian intent. Okay, so I think you need to decide, right, which of these, right, whether these positions appeal to one or the other, right, whether because you identify with rabbis who clearly, right, who did this, right, to what degree does it matter to you that Rabbi Sender clearly cares about art, right, part of the, next week, right, Ravinder will come and he'll take us through the MFA, right, so I hope you'll see that he cares about art. And so then the question is, are you willing to offer something that, that he took you through? The other thing which we have not addressed is that the two categories that exist in the Shulchan Aruch fundamentally are making art and possessing art. Maybe even deriving benefit from art. But deriving benefit is usually defined halachically in a particular way. But no one has talked about looking at art. Right now, looking at art is very hard to define to aser from lo tasuniti. I didn't make it. And even according to the Magen Mishnah, it's hard to create an answer of lo tasun lachem.
So wait, there's that Tosfos that talks about, right, the Hasidim who wouldn't look at the coins, right?
Yes. That's a Midas Chassidus.
What?
That's a Midas Chassidus.
Right, right. But it was part of a discussion that was based on, like, whether, right, like, the Buddhas are you not even supposed to look at or glasses, right?
So, but it's right. So we have, right, so we have a number of ways which we can construct, the Isurim for looking off it. We can construct the Midas Chassidus, right, which we just say, if it's wrong to have it, then obviously to stand in front of it and stare at it is wrong.
Well, no, not obvious.
Pretty.
They could have made a lot of those assumptions doing some of these about, if you can't make it, then obviously you can't possess it, and if you possess, I mean, you could have...
They can't possess it in a closet.
If you have it just because of chashad, then it...
Well, chashad may be worse. What's the, you know, what could be more chashad than having somebody stand in front of something for an hour studying it? That's more chashad than having it in your house?
Yeah. Well, that's more.
That's more chashad. Thanks to being an astral looking at it even more so.
No. Being in your house is more chashad.
Really?
Yeah, because just looking at something and contemplating it doesn't really seem like a voda. Bowing down to something and, like, you know, being makriv solid or whatever it is you would do, that seems like a voda zara. And if somebody's in their house, you don't know what they're doing.
I don't know. I have to say that I worried about this when I went to the Caravaggio exhibit at the Met. Like, the whole exhibit of, you know, explicitly Christian pictures. I was worried about Bar Dayan.
Really?
You walk in, you're standing in front of the picture with an obvious Christian motif for an hour.
It's a museum. It's an educational institution.
Yeah, well,
it's
education
not a
about what?
What?
Education about what?
Even if it's an education about a Avodah Zarah, it's Lislamate.
Aha.
Why do we need a
Lislamate? It's Lislamate, and it's Rabbim. What more could there?
Aha. So I'm talking, you know, whether Lislamate is an easy excuse. Maybe it's, you know, a good motive for becoming a rabbi. Is right, or a posik is to be able to go to museums and everyone and just say Lavi Loros, right?
You could probably teach that even if you're late.
Only Rebbeim. Ah, you could. So what does Lavi Loros mean? We're talking about the only Torah, or is it even to teach our history?
No, meaning you could learn. You go to museums to learn stuff to teach about Torah, even if you're not a rabbi.
Yeah. Okay. It could be on the kind, right? I teach Jewish art history. It depends what loving we have to talk about. Loving Lahoros, right? What does loving Lahoros mean? Does it mean to paskin, or does it mean to teach? And to teach what? And who gets to, and who gets offered? All those are open halachic questions. But I think the question, right? I think it's very easy to construct an issur of chashad for looking at things. It's possible to construct some kind of issur hana. It's certainly easy to construct a midas chassidus. And here again, we have the. An interesting question is one comfortable saying that there are paintings which it is worthwhile to look at, but certainly it would be usher to paint, and you should never own it. Right? Are we comfortable making that claim? Right. So some people make the kal v'chomer, make various kinds of kal v'chomers, right? Asiyasan, right? Then kol shekein tashmishan, or vice versa, tashmishan kol shekein asiyasan. Is one comfortable saying that there are things that is valuable? There are paintings that it is valuable to study but forbidden to own. Or statues.
Right,
it
makes a whole lot of sense to say intuitively.
Do you?
Yeah.
I don't know. What about everyone else? Right, do you think... Right, do you think... And you don't see any problem with enjoying that beauty.
No.
But you wouldn't want to own it.
Never.
See, that's interesting. I wonder, right? I have two people of intuition like that. I wonder, what do you think?
I don't feel drawn. No.
So that's an interesting thing. I think I would have a hard time, for example, saying that there are books I will only read in the library.
I think books are really different, though.
Why?
I think that, especially with an example like Christian art, I would go look at it not to enjoy CD, but to understand history and maybe something to do with, like, Christian-Jewish interactions.
But I wouldn't want to have that in my house or something to do with the book if it was important historically, or now because of something to do, but not to own.
You're finding a way to distance yourself from the. You think I only find third party value in it. What happens if you found it? Do you have any discomfort in finding religious meaning in a Christian religious painting? Is that okay? Ready to go? I want to go look at it because I think I will find out.
Seeing like crucifixion just makes me feel really, really awkward and really, really weird. And I don't see how like looking at any other kind of saint being tortured or whatever, or even if it's not a saint, just a saint, but I have no idea what they are or what they're for, other than like it reminds me like, oh, Jews used to get killed by people who really were inspired by them, but it doesn't feel any different.
I mean, I would imagine you would say, right, that there'd be plenty of books that you think are good and valuable to read, but you wouldn't want them in the Beit Medrash, right?
So that is an interesting...
similar type of intuition.
That's an interesting issue. Deborah and I have...
If we're talking about chashad, books are... You don't have as much of a chashad for books because you don't know what's in them when you read them.
I don't know. You look at the cover. That is two things. One is Deborah and I have this constant discussion about differences between technical Talmud Torah and actual Talmud Torah. So she takes the position, the Rasadigon position, I guess, the way of framing it, that all truth is Torah. So the problem with that is that you shouldn't be able to read astronomy textbooks in the bathroom. And you want to be able to read something in the bathroom. By the way, that's where the joke about people reading things, learning things in the bathroom goes back to a Medrash about Shmuel, right? Because the Gemara says that he says the mitzvah learned astronomy, but it's also a statement. He said you're not allowed to bend. Right, he never learned anything but Torah, and the solution is he learned astronomy in the bathroom. Right? It's not a Vilna-Gaon and geometry joke. It goes back further, but. So she writes, and I tend to take a, and she's really, you know, she, so her reductive absurdum always is, what happens if I find a tshuva which quotes an obsolete astronomy textbook? Is right? Can I make a bit right? It doesn't make any sense to her to say that I can make a Birkas HaTorah on that tshuva, but I can't make a Birkas HaTorah on a contemporary astronomy textbook which actually teaches me something about the world. That's a reductio ad absurdum. And I am very comfortable saying that there are things that are technical Talmud Torah, and there are things that are actual Talmud Torah. We make a Birkas HaTorah on reading texts that are identified as traditional Torah texts, and then you fulfill the mitzvah, perhaps, by learning things that teach you anything true.
Or you go farther and say, you wouldn't make a bracha on that tshuva.
Or you can write the...
You get a public... I mean, Rosh Hashanah, 2 years ago, you're learning Gittin, got up publicly and said, you can make a siyum on Masechet Gittin without doing the first two lot of the parak that talked about medicine.
So Rosh Hashanah is often as much more radical
right.
than I am,
right.
and much less traditional. So it doesn't surprise me that much. I tend to be very, very traditional. I think that once something makes it into a Torah text, it becomes Torah. It's a mitzvah studied, even though it happens to be, you know, to be wrong science. The issue the other way is, so let's say you have there's a book that probably many of you read called The Power and the Glory. No? No one? Not one person here has read The Power of the Glory?
Isn't that a film?
If I call it Ha'oz Ve'Ha'Hadar, will that make it better?
What?
If I call it Ha'oz Ve'Ha'Hadar and give it to you in Hebrew, will that make it better?
No, isn't that a film?
Is there any text in Hebrew that contains the words Ha'oz Ve'Ha'Hadar?
Yeah. Ve'Hadar? Uh-huh. The Pasuk in Tehillim. But the...
That's not Ha'oz Ve'Ha'Hadar.
I think you can look it up. I think it's there. So, Power and the Glory is a novel by a Catholic convert named Graham Greene.
He converted to Catholicism?
He converted to Catholicism.
From Judaism?
No, from some form of Protestantism or nothingness.
Oh, but his name is Graham Greene.
His name is Graham Greene, yeah.
He just sounds very Jewish.
No, there's absolutely nothing. There's, you know, Graham Greene. He died a few years ago.
Was it with a G or a
G.
I heard it was like Grom and Greenberg or something.
That's a Jewish name.
No, no, no. Trust me.
Sometimes.
Trust me. Yeah. Okay. No one has ever accused him of any smidgen of Jewishness.
Okay. Okay.
Communism, yes. Consorting with dictators, yes. But Judaism, Judaism, no. And that was the Hadar, is it? Which is, yeah, it was one of the books that you read. It's one of the books you used to read if you were either a student of Professor Carmi or you went to Gush. Right, who was part of the canon? I guess it's changed. It's a tremendously powerful book about what it means to be a religious leader, if one is aware of one's own sins. Tremendously powerful, but it's a book. You know, he's sort of like a Catholic Shalom Aleichem in that he always, right, that he never really comes to a position of true belief in the book. You know, and all his novels are somewhat ambiguous about, you know, about what the religious posture of the author is, but it's a tremendously powerful religious book. It's, you know, and I would say that, you know, that in my circle at YU, everyone had read it, and most people thought it mattered to them a great deal, and those people read it repeatedly. So any one of us walking into anyone else into others' houses, now you know, right? Knows that if you walk in, right, you'll see that book, and that's a book about a Catholic priest. And about a Catholic priest's religious experience. So we can't claim that people don't know it. And almost certainly it's going to have some kind of crucifix on the cover, because it's very hard to get an edition that doesn't have some kind of Catholic imagery on the cover. So I'd be much rather it didn't have that on the cover, I have to say. I'd much rather it didn't have it on the cover. I'm very bad at mutilating books, though, to tear off the front cover. And it seems churlish. Pardon? Book sack?
A book sack.
I could cover it.
Yeah.
I could cover it. Well, it's not on the spine. It's not on the spine. That's much more an issue when you get books from Christian publishing houses, like translations of the Bible. So they have crosses on the outside, and that's very annoying. But
I have a problem when we had to buy an NRSV Bible for one of our literature classes.
Uh-huh.
If I put it on the regular bookshelf, I feel like it's not Kabbalah Torah for the first half. And I put it on the Torah bookshelf, I feel like it's right, it's inappropriate for the second half. But I don't want to rip the book in half.
Well, the NRSV isn't so good anyway. the King James now. King James is an achievement. I think I had a hard time saying you must read The Power and the Glory in the library, but don't bring it home. Even an edition which doesn't have a cross on the cover, because you shouldn't own Catholic books.
But you bring it home, you just can't keep it. Like a library.
Ah, okay. So I have a hard time saying that. I don't, you know, honestly, I own it. I own multiple copies. I guess it makes some idea if I've given it to other people. I might have gotten my first copy from Professor Carmi, I don't know.
Okay, but it could also be just a question of, like, degree, right? Would you feel comfortable owning in your house, right, like a New Testament?
I own many.
Okay, so I guess you do.
But, yeah, there's somebody from Lyman who says you recommend to do it by heart. I think he must have owned one, too.
I mean, would you own, like, Mein Kampf? I mean, like, that's
just because I've read that.
It's not
the only place I've ever seen Mein Kampf has been in Jewish.
I'm really not worried about who the royalties are going to.
Like, if it was in my house, I would just be like, I would, like, feel it, like, in the room, and it would just make me feel so icky to have it there. The only place, like, I would feel comfortable, I know, I would not feel comfortable owning it in my house, though.
I own the English translation of the Constitution of the Republic of China. I was highly amused by that one. I don't think it exists, I don't think anyone else owns it.
Thank God we're learning Torah here, and we have a lot of people who are talking a lot in depth and in all the complexity about what things, right, you should feel comfortable about owning, what you should feel comfortable about making, and why. And so now
there's
a little bit of grounding between our conflicting intuitions.
Right, so I have, as I do in other areas of life where, you know, the things that seem really powerful and meaningful, and just sometimes you look up and you say, what am I doing here? Right? So sometimes I look at my copy of The Power and the Glory and I say, what is this thing on my bookshelf? On the other hand, it just really feels churlish. You know, this book has been tremendously important to me. If I have to pick the books that are important to me, the way I function as a rabbi, so, Yeah, that's there. Reinhold Niebuhr's diary of his first parish. Right, it's also a tremendously, also not randomly found, but recommended by rabbinic teachers. So I happen, I think Paradise Lost is beautiful. If you told me I couldn't own Paradise Lost, it's not like I'm likely to reread it again anytime soon. but it's a novel called The Least of All Saints, which is an evangelical Christian genre novel, which I love quoting, and it's really very powerful. So I think that's a fair question. I have a hard time distinguishing that and saying that there are things that I would get benefit from and acknowledge the benefit from, because even if halachically there's a way of making them not enough, and yet say it's usher to own. But it's not impossible, and it could be that, well, I haven't done this so in depth before, it could be that I'll find myself cornered I can't do it.
That is what it seems that the Gemara is saying explicitly about the Chaman Levanah, the case of Rabban Gamliel, right?
Well, he owned it. There's other people made it for him.
Right.
I don't have the same
right.
problem.
Yeah, they're right. Other people made it for him, right? He owned it, and there was a problem with him owning it that we have to get out of somehow.
Yes, but I don't know, they've been different.
Whatever way you cut it, whether the fact that he owned it or the fact that it was okay that he owned it was an exceptional.
The Gemara, so we can say, look, see, we can play that kind of game, right? We'll say, you know what? Look, the Gemara didn't give the answer. Rabbi Gamliel rented it. Or Rabbi Gamliel borrowed it from his friendly non-Jew. Right? So the fact that the Gemara didn't give the answer tells you it doesn't make a difference, right? Even if it doesn't make a difference with the owner, you look at it. Because otherwise, the Gemara had a very simple answer. It could have just said Rabbi Gamliel didn't own them. He sold them to Tevi as Evet, whatever, right? Before he could, right? I have a hard time. Now, why not? I can buy it from my friend.
But no, it belongs to him.
I can't steal it, but I can. But it's no problem my own. I don't happen to own it, but it's no problem.
You can have spiritual benefit from chametz, and you can't own it.
During Pesach? Who says you can get spiritual benefit from chametz during Pesach?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
So after b'hana.
Why couldn't you? But if it's not technical b'hana.
Because mitzvah lab lehanas nitnu. That's what we're gonna pull out, right? There's no right. So I can.
The concept of chametz.
No,
if you put bread on your
okay, you have
plate,
really pretty piece of bread.
No, you can't. You can't own it.
If there's a piece of bread, the way it's been shaped somehow reminds you of God. It makes you feel good about it.
Yeah.
And you go to look at it to give yourself a spiritual high, and you go on Pesach.
My brother-in-law does not allow the word donut.
What?
My brother-in-law does not allow the word donut or bread in his house. Because it's an Abizrahu. So I don't think he would agree with you.
Okay.
Well, it doesn't like paying it.
Oh.
It'll say it. Maybe he sells all the books. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think I would have a hard time if somebody told me, you know what, I can sell all my chametz, I can burn all my chametz for Pesach, but I'm going to go to the Met and stare at pictures of bread all day to remind me of God. I think that would kind of flip me out if somebody were to tell me that. I would probably look away on Pesach.
Okay.
Yeah, picture of the lechem upon him, probably look away, lechem on his matzah. But I wouldn't listen to Ijah Seid Chametz. What, is that a Schlock Rock song?
No.
What is it?
It's a Kolish song.
It's a Kolish song. Okay, I didn't know. I don't know, I think I'd have trouble on Pesach with deliberately going to, for that matter, to stare at store circulars with advertising bread. Because because just because it reminds me of the mitzvah of Mila.
It's actually better to be conquering your Yetzer Hara in order to do the.
I'm not going there. I'm not going there. Now, the other hand, I say my own into it. I don't have any trouble saying that there are things that it is valuable to read and mutter to own, but usher to write. I don't have any difficulty believing that it would be usher for me to write The Power and the Glory.
That's fine, but we're still in the world. At this point, we're still in the world of intuition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But but we know now that I can probably root any of these positions if I wish to. But with the appropriate group of Rishonim will get me the result I want. Right, on this regard, and I don't know how compelling the read is. So I'm interested in. I'm interested in those intuitions, and I'm always interested in how those intuitions change when they're confronted by text. It may be that I will discover that I can't, that the positions that are shown in that would allow me to sustain a position in which I could not have written the book, but I can read it and I would own it. You know, I can't say that with integrity of the text, and it turns out that there'll be a sale or a giveaway at the end of the summer. In which case, as now I'll tell you from my current vantage point, you should probably take the copies of The Power and the Glory. But, I give up all my possessions. I'll tell you which shares you want to tell me. You want to give it to me, or else. But I think, you know, I think the challenge that Jonathan poses, which is, I think it's fair to say that in this halachic discussion, there is no hint of a contrary value. We will begin to see, hopefully, tomorrow once I cut down 115 pages, so hopefully this will survive. We'll see that, obviously, there were other people who thought that this was valuable because they bothered to decorate the shuls that way, and the machzorim, and they put in the stained glass windows, right, and they illuminated the Haggadot, and they drew on their walls. All those sorts of things, there were people who thought they were valuable, but we can reject all those people and say they were either not rabbis or they were rabbis of insufficient stature, so we don't care about their intuition. Right? We should be careful about intuition. So if you take a look at the last discussion which talks about mirrors? Which one is it? There's one shiva I thought I had on here where somebody tried to assert something that was explicitly mutter in the Gemara. Do you remember which one it was?
Mirrors are not here. The last
one
was the Jews.
Yeah. There was something. Okay, I have to find it again. I found there was one, so maybe it's in one of the...
The quote of the
Jews is very partial. Yeah.
Yeah,
but
the only part that's bad.
But there was a case. There was a case where somebody tried to assert something that was explicitly mutter in the Gemara.
Maybe having an andarti of Hamelach in your shul.
Is that the one?
Oh, you mean the shul case?
Yeah. Where was that?
So that's in the first place. That's in the middle of the Shiva.
Oh, right, yeah, right, sorry. So, right, so in the Pisgei Tshuva, it's cut in chet, right, sorry, I had just crossed over something else, right, he says, where somebody says, the Af L'dasa Poskim D'Shol Rabim Lech V'Chshara, Haynu Daska B'Mokam Sh'Ein Bo Kedusha, right, which is explicit against the Perish of Gemara. And the Gemara talks about the...
He realizes that.
So the Pisgei Tshuva says, I don't understand what's going on, this is right, but then the final parenthesis is, right. If Efra Liyashim, the answer is against the Beferish and Gemara. There's no argument it's against the Beferish and Gemara. But you know what? You could find by distinction. So the Chaydei is laughing, and we go, right. And the Pshach anyway wrote there was Mechura Dover, right? So we go, intuitions go both ways.
Intuitions
are supposed to
go one way.
Yeah. So when people are willing to use their intuitions not only in blank areas but against explicit gemaras, people are willing to use intuitions. And to accuse, we have people, we have things that clearly are, you have the intuition of the Yaris Vash that you can't draw on walls, but Rav did it. That's it with Kona Chatzer. Right? So people's intuitions go pretty wildly against gemaras also, Lahachmir.
How strong of an impulse.
Yeah, exactly. I might forget all the specifics, but I'm still a Talmud. And the truth is, now it's safe for me to remember the specifics again. I think now I can learn the sugyot there. It was a big thing, actually, gave me the Losachmot shir last Sunday. That was a big thing, whether I could actually give shir on Losachmot, even though it was the first shir I'd ever heard from a person's like. And the answer was, I managed to find a way to construct an entire shir. And then at the end, I just said, and here's what I would have said if I'd given a presence like Sharon. But I managed to talk for 2 hours without mentioning it. So there's room again. So, the question is going to be, granted Jonathan's challenge, that in the discussion of Lo Ta'asun Iti and the prohibition against Tzurut Ovdei Kochavim in the Shulchan Aruch, there's no mention of the countervailing value. What happens if we find other sugyot which explicitly acknowledge a value that seems to us clearly to be in conflict with this? Right. That's really right. So what happens if we play Tosfot and we say, you know what, this sugya here seems to say this, and all the Tosfot seem to say this, but look at there, there's a sugya which says it's important. Okay, or really powerful intuition, like Ariel.
Clearly, the poskim are just big rotzim after a vodazah.
I would love to challenge at Ariel's intuition based on this, if nothing else. Meaning, it's not halachic, right? Let's say that what drives the shach and the ketuva, you know, is intuition. But Ariel is not just saying they misread the sugya; he's saying right, he's making a claim that this is what Judaism is about, which means that their intuitions were all off.
I think he would probably frame it as they had really good Gullus intuition. They had really good Gullus intuition.
I have a very strong intuition, which I have from Rulenstein, he got up there and he's like, you know, I love the Ramban, but the Ramban's notion that mitzvot are not, are not complete in chutzlars, and therefore Chaim didn't live a full life, is impossible. That was it.
Well, I have to say, I agree also. But I don't think Ramban meant that.
Right, but...
Yeah, you're right what I wrote this year, no? No, when Ramban says Eretz Yisrael, he doesn't mean the physical Eretz Yisrael. You have to look at the Ramban in his introduction, you discover the Eretz Yisrael from the Ramban is everywhere, or nowhere. It has nothing to do with the physical land of Eretz Yisrael when he says that. Hey, this is I'm advocating that thesis for now, so I agree entirely.
But at any point, the intuition, I think is true. I don't buy into this is, that was Gullus and this is not, and therefore all their intuitions are off.
So I don't like having to buy into visions of history. I'm almost happier, maybe actually happier, to buy into theories of art than I am to buy into theories of history in order to paskin. So I'd rather accept Rabbi Sender's notion that we should paskin only certain kinds of art or mutter if they reflect on themselves, that I would have to accept Rav Cook's messianism, and that say that we're really in a Chalta de Gula, and that's what makes it different. You may not feel it. I agree. I don't want to work on the basis of Ariel's intuition. Although Rav Ariel, I think, would be much firmer than the position we're attributing to him. Actually, we'll try and look by the end of this week. I have now been sent the Rav Ariel Haskama to shoot drama, in which he solved some of the questions we raised this Friday, very clearly.
To shoot drama.
Shoot drama.
Is it a new one?
The new one, yeah.
Same person.
Same person. After shoot drama, it came shoot drama.
Like,
but I'm told that the content is very much similar.
Shoot drama doesn't rhyme.
Shoot drama doesn't rhyme. Maybe you should call it shoot drama news. I don't know. Create a new word.
Shoot literature is coming out after that.
I suppose.
Shoot stuff root. That's fine. Ah. I mean, he could
for the record, I would probably
give
that
three parts, and the first one he could call drama kama.
We should put a preface on
that. For an under-order sense of humor.
Put on the recording. This was given on the
test. I'm not so comfortable going with the change of historical period, but I think that it's not unconventional to say, you know what, but sometimes there are areas of halacha which seem like they exist non-intention, and then we start looking at them, we discover all of a sudden this really is intention. This is the way lots of ethics and moral issues come up right now, where people never saw a particular halacha as being problematic ethically, and now all of a sudden it is, because this is entailed by what it means to be a human being. So I don't know. I think that there are. I will try over the next. I'll try over the next week and a half or so to construct ways in which you could either derive the language which would give art value, or ways in which you could fit the value of art into halachic language. But I think we have to be aware that there are no, to my knowledge, there is even on the simplest level, which is hider mitzvah. Right, I'm not aware of any tshuva which talks about how you prioritize. Right, is hider mitzvah worth passing like this shita as opposed to that shita?
I'm not sure anybody would do this in this coming conflict. Hider mitzvah, you can make a mitzvah, you can make your sukkah equally beautiful if you leave out the.
So there's just always a technical viewpoint. The halakha's position is that beauty is a black box, right? So if you view art as a product, purely as a product, and so then there's no challenge to say, there's no difficulty.
Because you don't believe that there is such a thing as art, then there's no conflict at all.
There's just beauty. Even if you think there's just beauty, but you don't see. If you don't see art as an expression of the artist, so you don't see the problem in telling them change this and a little bit of that, right? In producing Shakespeare, Shakespeare for Bessert.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we're talking about, like, if you have a painting where the focal point of the painting is a piece of Bodhisattva, so if you take it out and put in, like, one of those sensor things, it's not going to look pretty anymore. But, I mean, you can...
And it might be just as pretty, right? Say, why don't you just make that window frame a triangle instead of a square, which were the way for the window panes, right? You can easily do that, right?
You ever ask like a very like high class chef, you know, what about making like a kosher restaurant, right? And like it'll invariably be something to the effect of like, well, what do you mean I can't put butter in everything?
Yeah,
right?
No,
because like, you know, this is, right, my cooking is an art, and it's a personal expression, but, you know, we have a religion where we think that it's possible to create valuable things within certain constraints.
That's right. So I think that where Ferrariel has...
It's nice to be able to express yourself, but it's not like it doesn't bulldoze everything.
Right, so cooking is a good case, because I've gotten all sorts of shilohs from people attending cooking school, right, where, you know, you just can't do you can't learn French cooking unless you can cook baser b'chalav.
Mm.
Even at the end, you'll end up producing non-baser b'chalav dishes, but you can't learn French cooking without cooking baser b'chalav. And they want to learn French cooking, authentic French cooking. They don't want to own the results of the French cooking.
Okay, let's say you have somebody who said they really want to cook French cooking.
Yeah, no, I
thought... You can't baser b'chalav
as well.
It's not like we say there's no countervailing value of cooking. Right, we think that cooking is not valuable, and that's why we think machmir b'kashrut. Right, kol machmir b'kashrut is a function of our thinking that cooking is valueless. No, we're firm about kashrut. Same way we're firm about.
Well, we're not really though, because
we don't value.
We don't ban bacon bits
per se.
Right. Right. If we were the acronym here would be banning bacon bits.
People try.
Right. Some of they lost. Right, and now we all use bacon bits, which aren't so good anyway, wasn't it?
Yeah,
wasn't so worth it.
More
I don't know. When I read Sounder. That's like the one thing I remember from this kid's book Sounder is the smell of bacon in the morning. And it's a kid's book about the Deep South, a boy and a dog in the Deep South. But part of it focuses around the smell of breakfast. right, which is bacon and sausage.
So we're going to get a lot of people right now. Marzine is not Marzine, so everyone uses it.
Yeah, yeah.
And therefore, it's not that we couldn't have won, it's just that if the question is Marzine and no one does it, so then that doesn't prove anything.
If it's only Marzine and not... Some people just say it's Mechura Dover, right? Why should we... And other people say...
You're
And other people say no, right? Kol Mashak Bara Kadosh Baruch Hu, Asher Kadosh Baruch Hu Bara Heter Kenegdo, right? So we have our dueling Gemaras to fight about bacon bits. I tend to think that the difference between this and cooking is that there has been indigenous Jewish cooking, and right now I think that there are three different positions. You can take the position that artists should just take halakha as it is and work with it, and halakha as it is constraining. Oh, that's halakha is, like cooking. You can take the position that that artists have to be free, and we need to conform the halakha to artistic freedom, and that's that. You know, maybe a few very, very detailed rules, right? We can ban depictions of Avodah Zarah, L'shem Avodah Zarah, and Nakam Erva, and we'll go home, and we'll go home from there. The third position, which I think Rav Ariel offers as an alternative, although I don't know, think I would like it on his grounds, is to say that the halakha as we have it is not really hospitable to the creation of art as we have it. And we, meaning the halakha as we have it, meaning as we would paskin it, if we, right, as we would just paskin it if we had to do it straight as opposed to thinking about it. Right? If you were to write a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch mechanically, the halakha as we have it, right, and the wouldn't really fit. But we think that art like cooking should have rules and real rules. But we need to rethink what those rules are.
We need to rethink rules because now that we're in Eretz Yisrael, Jewish cooking is,
And we're not just in Eretz Yisrael. Now that we are, maybe now that we're in a Western democracy, now that we are full participants in a culture. We have the need and the opportunity to rethink it, because guess what? We have access to many, many more Rishonim than anyone ever did. And we live in an age in which...
You could do that in a lot more halakhos than
it. Yeah, you could. In the 1940s, everyone thought that's what we were going to do because of Zionism. I thought that we would rethink all these halakhos, women and non-Jews and civil law. We thought we would redo all of these. So it turned out we failed in all the others. Amazing if you read the writings of modern Orthodox rabbis in the 40s, what they thought would happen. Or Israeli religious Zionist rabbis in the 40s, what they thought would happen. I think it's possible to make an argument like that. We also live in a largely post-pagan culture in terms of images, and that offers opportunities also. Right? So we're not.
That offers us opportunities to rethink.
Yes.
Avodah Zarah, not to rethink.
Right, but not necessarily, because that reversed.
But maybe that's not true anymore. Right? Maybe it's not true anymore. Maybe if paganism is back, in some way, paganism came back in America. And it's a whole. Part of this really is a question as to what degree, how seriously you take the involvement of Eastern religion in contemporary Jewish life. Right? So I haven't really seen it, except for one.
I was at these people's house, and they were. Their whose entire experience of Judaism was their yoga classes.
I've gotten
the book they read about Judaism and Buddhism. No, they really knew only about Buddhism.
Roger Kamenetz. I've gotten fun shilas about whether people can go to meditation retreats, and a really cool shiloh about whether a Jew who ran a Buddhist temple wanted to learn about Yom Kippur so they could incorporate it into their Jewish Buddhist ritual. And so the question is whether you were allowed to teach him. That was a really interesting question.
Whatever happened with that?
I don't remember what I said. I remember it was a fascinating shiloh. I tend to think I was very uncomfortable with the notion of teaching him Dafka to incorporate it into a Buddhist ritual.
I'm just curious as to how he would have incorporated it had he learned about it.
Oh, they would have had a fast day. Perhaps. Onion Kippur.
I thought they were Davin Ila.
Maybe they were Davin Ila too. Who knows?
I mean, them having a day of fasting and repentance.
I mean, or
like
dedicated to the Buddha.
You have to know these religions very well. I know, this is one of the classic moments when someone asked Shaila whether he had baked a cake for his Hindu co-worker and accidentally put in eggs. And afterwards, he wanted to know whether he had to tell her so she could do tshuva. And he asked he posed the shaila to Rav Rosenzweig, to a panel.
These are non-egg eating Hindus?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he posed the shaila to Rav Rosenzweig, and David Berger. And Rav Rosenzweig,
you know, gave an answer for like 10 minutes about how we should value honesty, and it was very nice, and everyone was like, you know, and therefore, you know, you should tell her, and David Berger was like, that's really nice, except part of their tshuva process is about the Zara, so you can't tell them. And everyone was like, and everyone was like, oh. And everyone was like, right, you can't do that. And Rosenthal was like, oh, right.
Shamelim macharim lo tazkiru.
Exactly.
That's interesting. But I think that part of it is, you know, do you see yourself in a culture where fighting images, and look, again, I think it may just be that we don't appreciate the influence of Catholicism in the culture. And you could look around and say, you know what, it's Sharon, not so much, but in Somerville, you can walk anywhere without having the shadow of a cross or a crucifix fall on you. Harvard Hill has a major Catholic church across the street with crucifixes not only in the front, you can feel constantly conscious of that and feel that at least sculpture has to be banned. Because Chavariel is a fascinating thesis that we're supposed to be the middle ground. Right? And I don't know, you know, but maybe we're just supposed to be sympathetic with Islam on this. That's a perfectly reasonable position. And, you know, the concern for me is, so I have some feeling for certain kinds of visual art. I don't need sculpture. When I appreciate sculptures, I probably appreciate them as if they were two-dimensional portraits up on a wall. So I could easily see myself in terms of my religious experience, I think, at this stage in my life, will not be dampened in the slightest if I just say, you know what, nothing bully.
Yeah, but I'm sure there are plenty of other people who would say, well, our religious experience will be dampened.
So right, right. So I think the really underlying question here, the question I'm trying to find a way to address is, so you have three possibilities. One possibility is that you believe yourself or construct for yourself a completely objective process which does not take into account anybody's religious experience or artistic experience. This is what halacha is, so that's it. There's a second possibility, which is to say that it would be dishonest for me to do that, because in fact I have subjective experiences that inform what I think ought to be the case. That would legislate my artistic ideology and my own religious experience. Right, so I will combine the right standard, and I'll say that you can only do flat art that, right, which somehow tells you I am only an image. I am not the real thing. Right? Every painting must be titled. This is only a painting. And this is not a pipe. Right? Or the third possibility is to say that I recognize that I have certain intuitions which are not purely stemming from the Makorot, and that shape the way I understand the Makorot. My job is to find, right, is to construct halacha in such a way that everybody whom I respect, right, has the same opportunity. So I will write halacha generally enough so that people who don't share my understanding,
like vague writing,
vague,
like people reading you can.
Well, either I can write it vaguely, or I could write subjectively and say, right, and say, right, that your job is to, right, you can only go to art. No, you can only go to art that accords with your own sense of X and Y. Alright, and then, you know, and I can talk about the theory, I can talk about it very specifically, right? Do I want to paskin that particular paintings are usher? Or do I want to paskin that, right, I want to paskin that particular schools are, right, schools are usher? You know, we'll go back to the Picasso that I talked about yesterday, you know, which I thought was evil, and Chava agrees with me. But
why is it evil?
So that's a really interesting question. You know, it's a sign that I have a certain artistic sensibility. I can actually experience a painting as evil. It struck me as an attack on human dignity. A straightforward attack on human dignity. That's how the painting felt to me. Now, apparently that's not why the paintings were controversial. They were controversial because it was thought they were depicting women as if they were men. Right? He was painting nude women as if they were masculine. And maybe I experienced that as evil, who knows? All right, maybe I experienced that as an attack on women as women. At least I assume that it's the same, that it's the same painting that I saw, that I saw the slide of. So, but, you know, I don't think I want to paskin Daska that painting of Plato is usher. That painting of Picasso is usher because I experience it as evil. Although, if you ask me, you know, if I had a choice, would I try to prevent everyone from seeing it except Lavina Lahoro? Yeah. But I think it's a bad painting to see. I think it can only corrupt you. And so that's the whole... There are books that are bad also, you know. There are books that are corrosive. There are some books that are good
for... But then if that's the motivation,
yeah.
Then that is the motivation. I mean, you could just say, I think reading this book will turn you into a horrible person, and turning into a horrible person is bad, therefore
it's usher, right? Because it's lush neighbor. Or, right, it's
Mishnah
to middle of Nafshat
Seikha. Something like that, but why would
you
try to frame it...
It has nothing to do with anything we've learned so far this month.
But why would you try to frame it otherwise? Just because you think it...
Well, I can think it's plausible that lots of paintings like this will, so, you know, so... And that I could argue that's what, you know, that's what Lo Tassuniti is designed to prevent somehow. I don't know.
So Lo Tassuniti is really Leviticus.
Well, it's really designed to prevent you from searching after Avodah Zarah. And Avodah Zarah is really about the denigration of the true Tzelem of Elohim, the human being, in favor of other images.
But you're implanting a lot of philosophy that...
Okay, you don't like it. I don't know. But what I really want to get you thinking about is to what extent your own theories of that, and to what extent that should play into law. And now we really need to be done because it's getting late. So I shall finish for the day.